The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Rutger Bregman is a historian and author. His newest book, Humankind, A Hopeful History, aims to prove that, at the root of it, every human is good-natured, benign rather than malign. Rutger has been musing over how we can change global inequality. He'll be participating in the International Literature Festival Dublin on the 20th of May. And Rutger Bregman joins me on the line. Rutger, good morning and welcome to our programme.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm just reading some of the things that you say. You say, I believe in a future where the value of your work is not determined by the size of your paycheck, but by the amount of happiness you spread and the amount of meaning you give. I believe in a future where the point of education is not to prepare you for another useless job, but for a life well lived. I believe in a future where an existence without poverty is not a privilege, but a right we all deserve. Utopian.
Yeah. Well, utopias have a tendency of coming true, right? Every milestone of civilization was once a complete fantasy. Think about democracy or equal rights for men and women or the welfare state. People who first argued in favor of those ideas were dismissed as crazy idiots. So I guess that the job of writers and intellectuals is to, you know, think about what could be the next milestone. What should we be striving for?
And you encourage us not to feast on news all the time, because news, by definition, is the exceptional, not the norm. And who compared it to, like, it's as bad for you as sugar.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think that there are many news reporters who wake up every day with the simple question, what is the worst thing that happened today? And then what happens is that a lot of people are hooked on the news, right? Around 90% of people in the Western world consume the news on a daily basis. And the news is mostly about exceptions, about things that go wrong, about corruption, about terrorism, about violence, about all these kind of things. And so what you get if you follow a lot of the news is you become more cynical and more depressed. There's even a term for this in psychology. You know, psychologists call it mean world syndrome, where you just, are more anxious and cynical, etc. It's really not good for your mental health. So what I recommend is that people try and zoom out and sort of try and look at the bigger picture. And sometimes that means, you know, staring at the facts or looking at the facts, right? Be realistic. There are a lot of things to be worried about, such as, you know, whether it's climate change or extinction of species, etc. But there are also good reasons to be optimistic and hopeful for the future.
Now, you talk about the debate between Thomas Hobbes, the Hobbesians, and those who were followers of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau believed that man is naturally good, and it's from institutions alone that men become wicked, whereas Hobbes insisted that left to their own devices, people will turn on each other. And I suppose that's the Lord of the Flies argument.
Yeah.
You believe, though, in Rousseau's contention that people are fundamentally good.
Yes. For a very long time, Rousseau was dismissed as the naive idealist, right? This crazy Frenchman who had these romantic views of human nature, but was not very realistic. But what's really interesting is that in the last couple of decades, there's been sort of a scientific revolution. Many scientists from very diverse disciplines, anthropologists, archaeologists, psychologists, sociologists, you name it, have moved from a quite cynical view of human nature, of who we are as a species, to a more hopeful view. Now, I'm not saying we're all angels or we're all perfect or, you know, fundamentally good, but we have evolved to work together, and that is actually our secret superpower. Biologists even talk about survival of the friendliest these days, which means that for millennia, it was not the nastiest among us or the most narcissistic people, but actually the friendliest people who had the most kids and so had the biggest chance of passing on their genes to the next generation, because being friendly helped you to survive, you know, in the Ice Age. So that's really interesting. It's a profound shift from what people used to believe like 40, 50 years ago. And I think it has major implications for how we organize our society.
Now, the idea that people are fundamentally benign rather than malign, and then people say, well, what about the Holocaust? What about Auschwitz? And you also discussed that famous Milgram experiment where people, you know, were ordered by some voice telling them to do nasty things with electric shocks and so on. And turns out you kind of dismiss that as being a flawed experiment. But how do you explain the Nazis?
Yeah, well, I can't pretend to sort of give a short explanation of something as terrible as the Holocaust or many of the other atrocities in history in a short radio interview, right? That would be ludicrous. But what I could say is that there's been this really old theory in Western culture which says that our civilization is only a thin veneer, just a thin layer, and that below that lies raw human nature, that deep down we're all just selfish and nasty. And that just when there are, you know, things like a crisis or a war, that we basically reveal who we really are. And especially after the Second World War, that theory became really influential again. Indeed, it was expressed with experiments like the one you mentioned, the Milgram experiment with the shock machine. People will probably also have heard of the Stanford Prison Experiment, in which, you know, these average students, you know, who were, you know, seemingly quite nice, turned into these sadistic monsters once they were given the opportunity to be so. And I think that's really the wrong explanation. I think we have to go much deeper. And what you then find out is that actually we often do the most terrible things in the name of friendship, in the name of loyalty, because we don't want to let our own group down. I'm not saying that's a comfortable explanation, right? In many ways, it's quite disturbing. Because it makes you think, am I actually on the right side of history? I mean, I may feel I'm on the right side, but, you know, that's generally the case with people who do terrible things. So.
You talk about how people can depersonalize their personal interactions. For example, the pilot of a drone sitting in some cabin in Wisconsin who's killing people in Afghanistan just by almost playing a video game. Easy to do that, far more difficult to kill that person with a knife face to face.
Exactly. The psychology of violence is so fascinating. We know from history and psychology that most people find it incredibly difficult to be violent or to kill another human being, right? We have so many accounts of soldiers who, when the moment comes, just can't do it. There's evidence from the Second World War, for example, that the vast majority of soldiers who were just drafted, right, and who had not been properly conditioned or brainwashed, as you may call it, to kill other people, well, most of them couldn't do it. There was one American historian and military man who discovered that only around 15 to 25% of American soldiers were able to actually shoot at the enemy. We know from the Battle of Waterloo, for example, or the Battle of the Somme during the First World War, that only around or less than 1% of the casualties did have bayonet wounds. Most bayonets throughout history have not been used because it's psychologically almost impossible to do it for most people. Now, obviously, there are ways to overcome this, right? By increasing the distance. Distance, you could say, is the root of all evil, right? When people get farther away from us, become more abstract, then we become able to be nastier. You can see this on Twitter every day, right? When people are anonymous and sitting behind their computer screen, they sometimes turn into these sadistic monsters. But if you would actually meet them and look, look eye to eye, then it turns out they're quite friendly. Yeah.
But you can take that to a different point of view. You can say that the people on Twitter are able to be themselves when they're anonymous, but they're forced to conform when they meet people face to face.
That's an interesting point. I would argue that it's the other way around, though. So if we look, for example, at the effects of being violent or killing someone else on the perpetrators, it damages them. So compare it to human needs like, we all want food, and it makes evolutionary sense because without food, we die. Most of us enjoy sex because if we don't have sex as a species, well, again, we go extinct. But then if you look at the effects of killing someone else, well, it often traumatizes the perpetrators. So, for example, after the war in Vietnam, so many American soldiers came back with PTSD. You know, they had not only killed someone else, but also killed something inside themselves, right? Which suggests to me that even though we're capable of the most horrific behavior, and in some ways we're one of the cruelest species in the animal kingdom, but it's not really what we've been evolved to do, right? It's you could argue, and this is classic Rousseau again, that there's a mismatch between our nature, our fundamental desires, and the environment we live in.
Yeah, you make the point that in terms of doing nasty things, be it killing or something similar, we're not born to do this, but we're mm-hmm. capable of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's obviously one of the ironies of writing a book about human decency or human friendliness, is that you have to go on for hundreds of pages about all the atrocities in human history, because that itself has to be explained. But then on the other hand, it's interesting, if we think about our own language, when we say something is humane or inhuman, I think that's already a recognition of the fact that when, you know, we do terrible things to each other, it's also a violation of our own humanity.
Now, you talk about the universal basic income as a way of changing things because, mm-hmm. you know, many people are not going to have jobs in the decades to come as robots do more of it and so on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how are you going to live? And the universal basic income would give people enough money for food, for a roof over their heads, for education and some leisure, I suppose. Otherwise, they would go bonkers. Mm-hmm. And it has been tried in small areas, in a town here or a town there. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it, you know that expression, the poor are always with us? Mm-hmm. The idea yeah. of people who only have the basic income will still be the poor.
Yeah. Well, this is one of those ideas that may seem completely ridiculous right now, but, you know, could become common sense in the future. And our grandchildren may look at us and wonder, why didn't they have a basic income for everyone, right? How could they justify living in a society where, you know, there was not a floor in the income distribution and some people had to live on the streets or in poverty? You know what? We are so incredibly rich today is that we can simply afford to give everyone enough to provide their basic needs, food, shelter, education. And I think we would all benefit. I think it's actually an investment. There's a huge amount of evidence now from experiments around the globe that if you eradicate poverty, you have to spend less on things like the effects of crime or on healthcare. You basically give people the opportunity to become citizens and contribute and become taxpayers, et cetera, et cetera. So we shouldn't look at this as some kind of zero-sum thing where we take away something from, say, the rich and we give it to the poor. No, it's something. It's a policy, I think, where we could all benefit. So it requires you to think in win-win terms, I'd say.
A win-win. I'm just wondering, from the economic point of view, that if you establish a basic income across an entire economy, unlike in places where they've had the experiment in maybe a Danish town or an Icelandic town or a Finnish town, I don't know, but they've done these experiments. But if you do it right across the economy, I would suspect that providing this universal basic income would just cause prices to rise right across that economy and people would still be priced out of certain things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a common argument against basic income. It all depends on how you finance it. So if you would just print additional money to give everyone, you know, a basic income, then sure, at some point you'll get inflation. Now, there are quite a few economists who say that some amount of inflation might be actually good for the economy right now. But, you know, I agree, you don't want that, you know, in the long term. So how do you finance a basic income? Well, you do not increase the total amount of money. No, you use taxes. And I think taxes are quite wonderful things. You know, we've had rising inequality in the Western world for decades now. I think there are really good reasons to basically ask more of the rich to fund sensible things like a universal basic income. And I think this can go perfectly well together with a functioning capitalist economy. So if you look at the 50s and the 60s, for example, in places like the UK and the US, you had taxes that went as high as 90%, you know, marginal tax rate for the very rich. You had inheritance taxes of around 90%. And this was also the era with, you know, the highest economic growth, much more innovation than we have right now. So I think it's perfectly
sensible. And Rutger, you made that argument on Fox News to Tucker Carlson, mm-hmm. which caused him to go apoplectic, the idea that he and people like him would be paying 90%. They never broadcast that interview between you and he, where he was reduced to using expletives. Have you ever heard from Fox since then?
No, I'm still waiting. No. I guess they didn't want to hear that. But it was a quite hilarious thing to experience, indeed. That
once and you people talk can about look at that room, online,
suddenly don't air the interview anymore.
Here's a question from one of our listeners on News Talk. Dehumanizing the other is critical to people accepting killing as justified. The Nazis labeled the Jewish people as rats in Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia. A similar process played out, with leaders describing the other group as cockroaches and so on. This made their followers okay with mass murder. I think we saw the dehumanization of Muslim Arabs in the eyes of many Americans post 9/11. How does your guest equate that we can all be made hate like this with his idea that we're all fundamentally good?
Yeah. So that's why I wouldn't say we're all fundamentally good, right? I think we've evolved to work together, to be friendly, etc. But there's really a dark side of human nature as well. And I think it's very well described in this way, that we have this capacity of dehumanization. I would only say that it's not just something that, you know, quickly happens. It's not like you put someone in a, you know, in a laboratory, or there's a fancy experiment and people suddenly turn into monsters, right? It's a very gradual, complex historical process. And we're all there when it happens. You know, we can notice the signs, we can notice the symptoms, and we can fight against it, right? We can try to do our very best every single day to keep on recognizing the humanity in each other. And I would say that, you know, it's not only true for humans, but it's also true for animals. We know that, you know, how the whole meat industry works also works by, well, I can't use the word dehumanization, but I don't know, sort of denying the, how do you say that? The feelings of animals, etc. And most people couldn't eat the meat they have on their sandwich if they actually knew the animal that they were eating, or had seen just a short video of that animal's life.
Carnivorous animals don't particularly worry about that when they hunt their prey as well. So,
well, most people wouldn't eat their dog, right? So I think that there's already some there's some sign of a, how do you say that, cognitive dissonance there. Your listener pointed this out very well, is that we have this very disturbing capacity to, I don't know, close our eyes, dehumanize others, etc. And it's something we got to fight against.
Well, the book is called Humankind, A Hopeful History. There's a different title in Dutch, which perhaps is more subtle. But I leave that to you to describe, perhaps to your audience, at the International Literature Festival in Dublin, when I believe you'll be in conversation with Louise O'Neill on the 20th of May at 6 o'clock. Tickets for this online event, a virtual event, can be got from ilfdublin.com. But Rutger Bregman, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today.